Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. This week, we're looking at how truth and the pursuit of truth can create a work of genius, or send you down murky rabbit holes of intrigue and self-deception. We'll hear how the Man Booker-winning novelist Richard Flanagan capitalised on his inglorious early days as a ghostwriter, but first, we flatter ourselves that many of our guests are of genius material, but rarely do we have bona fide certification. Now along comes Jesmyn Ward, who won a 2017 MacArthur Fellowship, also known as Genius Grants, to support her in writing novels that explore the enduring bonds of community and familial love among poor African Americans of the rural South, against a landscape of circumscribed possibilities and lost potential. When she joined Richard Lee down the line from New Orleans, she began by reading from her latest work, Sing, Unburied, Sing. Here, the protagonist, a little boy called Jojo, watches as his troubled mother, Leonie, drives away, leaving him home alone.
"I'll be back," she said. Sandwich in hand, I trotted after her. The door slammed and I pushed through it. "You gonna leave me here by myself?" I wanted to ask her, but the sandwich was a ball in my throat, lodged on the panic bubbling up from my stomach. I'd never been home alone. "Mama and Pop be home soon," she said as she slammed her car door. She drove a low maroon Chevy Malibu that Pop and Mam had bought her when she'd graduated from high school. Leonie pulled out the driveway, one hand out the window to catch the air wave, I couldn't tell which, and she was gone. Something about being alone in the too quiet house scared me, so I sat on the porch for a minute. But then I heard a man singing in a high voice that sounded all wrong, singing the same words over and over. "Oh, Stagger Lee, why can't you be true?" It was Stag, Pop's oldest brother, with a long walking stick in hand. His clothes looked hard and oily, and he swung that stick like an axe. Whenever I saw him, I could never make out any sense to anything he said. It was like he was speaking a foreign language, even though I knew he was speaking English. He walked all over Bois Sauvage every day, singing, swinging a stick. Walked upright like Pop, proud like Pop. Had the same nose Pop had. But everything else about him was nothing like Pop, was like Pop had been wrung out like a wet rag and then dried up in the wrong shape. That was Stag. I'd asked Mam once what was wrong with him, why he always smelled like armadillo, and she had frowned and said, "He's sick in the head, Jojo," and then, "Don't ask Pop about this." I didn't want him to see me, so I jumped off and ran around the back to the woods. There was comfort in that, in hearing the pigs snuffle and the goats tear and eat, and seeing the chickens peck and scratch. I didn't feel so small or alone. I squatted in the grass, watching them, thinking I could almost hear them talk to me, that I could hear them communicate. Sometimes when I looked at the fat pig with splashed black spots on his side, he'd grunt and flap his ears, and I'd think he meant to say, "Scratch here, boy." When the goats licked my hand and headbutted me while nibbling at my fingers and bleated, I heard, "The salt is so sharp and good, more salt." When the horse Pop Keeps bowed his head and shimmied and bucked so that his sides gleamed like wet red Mississippi mud, I understood. "I could leap over your head, boy, and oh, I would run and run, and you would never see anything more than that. I could make you shake." But it scared me to understand them, to hear them, because Stag did that too. Stag stood in the middle of the street sometimes and had whole conversations with Casper, the shaggy black neighborhood dog. But it was impossible to not hear the animals because I looked at them and understood instantly, and it was like looking at a sentence and understanding the words, all of it coming to me at once. So after Leonie left, I sat in the backyard for a while and listened to the pigs and the horses and old Stags singing, sinking to silence like a whipping and dropping wind. I moved from pin to pin, watching the sun and estimating how long Leonie'd be gone, how long Mam and Pop were gone, how soon I could expect them to come back so I could go inside the house. I was walking with my head tilted up, listening for the growl of tires so I didn't see the jagged lid of the can rising from the earth. Didn't see it when I put my foot on it, stepped down in the instinct of walking. It sank deep. I screamed and dropped, holding my leg, and I knew the animals understood me then, too. "Let me go, Great Tooth. Spare me." Instead, it burned and bled, and I sat on the ground in the horse's clearing and cried and tasted ketchup and acid at the back of my throat and grabbed my ankle. I was too scared to pull the lid out, Then I heard a car door slam shut and nothing else until Pop's voice called and I answered and he found me sitting on the ground, sniffing with my breath hitching and not caring my face was wet. Pop came to my side and touched me on the leg like he does our horse when he's checking the shoe. In a quick second, he pulled it out and I hollered. It was the first time I thought Pop didn't do something good.
I just thought I wanted to start, if you can just permit me this luxury, start by just saying congratulations. A genius forever now.
Thank you very much.
What's it feel like to be actually officially awarded that stamp?
It's amazing and wonderful, but it's odd. Yes, it's very odd. I mean, it's surreal. I don't think that it...
Odd how? Odd why?
Why?
Isn't it just great?
It is great, but it's... It is great, but I'm very shy. I was never the most confident or assertive student in any of the classrooms that I ever was in. So it's it feels odd, I think.
Feels like one great big giant classroom.
Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, moving on from instant genius and celebrity and fame and classrooms of various sorts, how did you get started on Sing Unburied Sing? What was the spark?
Jojo was the spark. He came to me first. I was casting about for novel ideas, and I thought, you know, what would it be like to be a 13-year-old mixed-race boy growing up in the modern South? I know that sounds odd, but it's true. So that's how I first envisioned his character. That's how he came to me. And then once he was there, then I was curious about him, and I wrote a first chapter, it was bad, threw it away, I wrote another one. And I don't know, I did that for around 3-4 months. And then I put Sing, Unburied Sing aside, actually, and wrote my memoir instead, because that story seemed more urgent. But Jojo was still, he was still in the back of my head, he was still there. And so when I finished the memoir, then I returned to Sing and really started to... you know, seriously work on it again and tried to write a good first chapter.
Yeah, that's a question of finding his voice, was it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just the way that he talks, the things he's worried about, the way he sees.
Yes. His voice was clearest to me out of all the characters. I think that part of what was making writing a good beginning complicated for me was that I couldn't figure out who the people were around him. So I didn't have a good handle on Pop or his mother, Leonie. Originally, I think he had 3 siblings instead of 1. So really, it was like the other characters were complicating things for me and confusing me.
So you could kind of hear him talking, but you weren't sure where he was at.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Is it part of the same project that you began in Where the Line Bleeds, to tell the stories of the people around you, to move beyond the kind of flat stereotypes that people often apply to these people and present them as complicated individuals?
I think so. I mean, that's something that I feel like that I strive to do in all my work, you know, to, you know, complicate the people that I write about, to make them come alive on the page as fully, you know, fully like real human beings. Because, I mean, ultimately what I'm trying to do is invite readers into my world and help them to see the kind of people that I'm writing about as real human beings, as complicated people. And I want them to feel some empathy for the kind of people that I write about.
We're back in the red mud, the pine needles of rural Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But it's a kind of different fictional world, a world where Jojo can understand what animals are thinking, like looking at a sentence, or where a midwife can hear the voices of people's wounds. Where did all the magic come from?
I've always wanted to write a novel that incorporated a bit of magic. And I didn't do it because I was afraid and because I didn't know whether or not I could pull it off. You know, I mean, when you incorporate magic into fiction, you know, you can't kick your reader out of the narrative, right? Your reader has to believe it. They have to feel that it's real. You know, you have to create an entire world. You have to build a world. That world has to have a logic. And I didn't know if I'd be able to do that. But I'm glad that I did, and I felt like I grew as a writer. And,
so it's a question of increasing confidence, of giving yourself permission to follow it where you wanted it to go.
Exactly.
I was wondering if it might be at some kind of maybe subliminal level, a kind of response to the accumulation of death in your own life that you describe in the memoir you were just talking about. Indeed, a response to the accumulation of death in modern America.
You know, I... I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, I would like to believe that there's more than we see. And I think that writing this kind of reality, you know, into my fiction maybe gives me hope that there's something more than we see, and that the people that were with us and that left, that they still remain in some way.
Yes, it's almost as if your fiction suddenly found it impossible to ignore the voices of the dead.
That's very true. That's very true.
I guess there's an element of challenge that you just alluded to in that these magical elements might make it awkward to mesh with the ambition to describe life in the rural South as it really is.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, that's something that I committed to do in my first work, you know, like from my first novel on, that I, you know, committed to sort of telling the truth about the kind of people that I write about and about, you know, the rural South and about the realities of the lives that they lead. And I think that with every book that I recommit to it. And so, you know, I know that when I began Seeing Unburied Sing and as I, you know, was working on that first draft, that was something that weighed heavily on me and that I felt that sense of responsibility that even though I was sort of imbuing this story with magical elements, I still couldn't turn away from the truth of the characters' lives, right? You know, like I had to write about addiction, I had to write about police brutality, I had to write about poverty, right? And generational poverty, I had to write about racism. All those things, you know, weighed on me while I was writing Seeing Unburied Sing. And I think also all of the, like my awareness of all of that made me want to write about Parchman Prison, also made me want to write about the ghosts, right? Especially Richie, you know, who is a ghost of a boy, of a 13-year-old boy who was in Parchman Prison with JoJo's grandfather in the 1940s, right? And children like him really existed. So, you know, so I think that I was, you know, aware of that history, aware of that violence, that brutality, and I wanted to write about that. And so I used magic in order to do it.
Is it almost that history like that, or the violence, the brutality that history contains, almost needs more than realism to really reflect that reality?
I think so. I mean, you know, because I had to do a lot of research in order to write this book, especially about Parchman Prison, because I knew next to nothing about it. And, you know, while I was doing that research, that's when I learned the fact that there were children like Richie who existed, you know, who droves of, you know, young black boys, children who were sent to Parchman Prison, you know, for small offenses and basically sent there to be enslaved again, to be tortured, and sometimes even to die. And so immediately, as soon as I found out about him and about people like him, I wanted to introduce him into this book as a character, but as a character that had agency and had voice that he was denied in life. And in order for that to happen, he had to be a ghost. I had to, you know, I had to use magic.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the herbal remedies and the gree-gree bags. I'm just wondering if that's, again, just part of reflecting a rural experience rather than an urban one.
I think that's part of it, you know, that I am reflecting a rural experience. But I also think that herbal medicine and voodoo and hoodoo, that, you know, in some respects, those are black spiritual traditions, right? And I think that those traditions have been maligned, at least in the United States. And I wanted to push back against that a bit, because my understanding of them, you know, of these traditions is that, you know, those traditions allowed us to survive, right? Those traditions allowed, you know, my ancestors to, they allowed them some agency, you know, some power that they were denied in the outside world, that they were denied at every turn. And so I think that those traditions are important. And I, you know, I just wanted to cast them in a different light.
You talk about writing about black tradition, about that being kind of a central part of what you're after. Do you relish or reject a kind of label as a black writer?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I am. I am a black person living in the United States of America. I grew up, my understanding of myself is that I am a black person. And so I have no problem with that. I mean, it doesn't mean, just because I write about black people, you know, black Southerners, you know, poor black people, that doesn't mean that the stories that I tell are not universal. You know, I mean, and I think that anyone who gives my work a chance and who reads it will see that, right? You know, in the end, I'm writing about, even though, you know, my characters, you know, are, you know, come from a particular place in a particular community. If you look at them and look at what they're struggling with, right, and if you look at, you know, their joys and their sorrows, I mean, these are very human situations that they find themselves in, right? I mean, these are parents grieving children. These are children, you know, realizing that parents can sometimes fail them. These are sisters grieving brothers, you know. So, you know, so I think that the characters that I write about are struggling with very human things, and they happen to be Black. And, you know, it is what it is.
There's a chain of stories that stretches back from Jojo comforting Kayla with that tale about the rabbit who's the best at digging holes, through Pop telling and retelling his time at Parchman, and remembering then his grandmama telling him about her great-grandmama's stories of the village and the ships that sunk bit by bit into the water. Is one of the ambitions of this novel to capture that kind of oral history on the page?
I think so. I mean, at the time when I was writing Sing and Bird Sing, I was also thinking a lot about storytelling, about oral storytelling, about how important storytelling is, especially to Black families in the South, because, you know, like that's our way of reclaiming our history and of trying to keep track of our history. You know, I mean,
preserving something that's being pushed to the margins everywhere.
Exactly. I mean, because it's so hard to, I mean, as far as like official documents go, it's really hard for us to trace, you know, who we are, you know, where our family members came from. It's really hard for us to trace our ancestry. And so I think that oral storytelling is really important in that respect.
As well as being full of stories, it's also a novel that's full of song. Again, you've got Jojo patching together nursery rhymes like pieces of a puzzle that almost fit, or Richie looking for a place that is the song that he wants to be part of, and then Kayla finally finding a song that gives something like relief. Is this another part of rural Mississippi that you wanted to capture?
Well, I mean, I think song and music have been important in the African-American experience, you know, since the beginning. You know, I come from Mississippi, and it's, you know, we're known as like the birthplace of American music in some respects, right? The birthplace of blues, right? Which sort of led to everything else. So I wanted to acknowledge that. And when I was attempting to sort of build this supernatural world or this magical world, using song to do so just made innate sense to me.
I mean, it's a part of African-American life that has not only been vital as part of African-American culture, but has also been kind of co-opted by the market and then in turn turned into kind of an escape from poverty as well. So it's this kind of multifaceted, rich vein of thing.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's part of the reason why, often at the front of my novels, I use, you know, lyrics from by Southern hip hop artists or by musicians, right? Because, you know, because I don't know, I want to acknowledge how important they are. I wanted to acknowledge how important their voices are, and the fact that I think that they're carrying on in this sort of tradition of creating art that helps us survive, I think.
And is it almost a strange magical thing, you might say?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I guess this is the first novel you've written in a world after the Black Lives Matter protests started. It's the first you've published with President Trump. Mm. Does the world around you need more than realism?
Yes, because reality is really hard to live with right now, you know, for all of us. And it's really hard to live with. And so I think that in some ways that I'm sort of, you know, in my work, I need to believe, and I need to write about something else. You know, like I need to believe that there's something more than this. And so perhaps it was an indulgence, but I needed it. And sometimes you have to take and you have to create what you need.
If this is the first step, as it were, into that magical territory, what's coming next? Are you going to be revisiting it?
So I am currently working on a novel that will be a very different book. It will be very different from anything that I've ever written, because it's a novel that is set in New Orleans during the height of the domestic slave trade. And I can imagine that there will be some magical elements in it, because it's very hard to, you know, right now with like living in America right now with the, you know, administration that we have in the White House and the people that we have in power, it's very hard as a Black artist to sit down and to write about slavery, you know, to put yourself back in that moment in time. And so it probably will have some magical elements because I imagine that I will, I'll need that.
Jesmine Ward talking to Richard Lee there. Now we head off to the other side of our huge global parish to meet up with the Australian author Richard Flanagan. I think we can safely say he's the only Tasmanian Booker Laureate, and he won the UK's Premier Literary Prize in 2014 for The Narrow Road to the Deep North, a sweeping masterpiece about the construction of the Burma Death Railway during the Second World War, which was written as a tribute to his father, a prisoner of war in Burma at the time. For this latest novel, First Person, Flanagan looks to his own multicoloured life. As a penniless wannabe novelist in 1991, he received $10,000 to spend 6 weeks writing the autobiography of John Friedrich, one of Australia's most notorious con men. First Person is a novel about Kif, a penniless wannabe novelist ghostwriting the memoir of, yes, you guessed it, an infamous con man. As the work gets underway, Kif begins to fear he's being corrupted, and his own story is being rewritten by the fraudster. Flanagan's work is often difficult to pigeonhole, but I decided this is a black comedy, so when I interviewed him at a Guardian Live event in London, I began by asking him if he accepts that description.
Oh, well, I think definitions belong to the definer, you know. It's not for me to say what it is. I mean, the lovely thing about this novel is that I've had a more varied response to it than any of my other books. So some people find it deeply comic, some find it deeply troubling, some find it shallow and superficial. But I mean, the thing is that there's a, I think as a writer, what you want is a varied response. If you only have one response, if readers only find one thing, you've really only written an extended tweet, and that's not a novel.
So would you just start by reading a bit of it? So maybe people will get what I'm talking about, or maybe they won't.
Okay. Well, I'll be very brief reading. I've done German reading tours, and they proceed on sort of geological sort of timescales, and that's sort of like Stalingrad, except it's seemed to be literature. So I won't do that to you. I'll stand if that's all right. Okay. Our first battle was birth. I wanted it in, he wanted it out. All that day and half of the next we argued. He said it had nothing to do with him. Later I began to see his point, but at the time it seemed bloody-mindedness and evidence of an inexplicable obstruction, as though he didn't actually want any memoir ever written. Of course, he didn't want a memoir written, but that wasn't his point, or the point. But I only realised this later, much later, when I came to fear that the beginning of the book was also the end of me. Too late, in other words. These days I content myself with reality TV. There is a void, a loneliness that aches and rattles, that frightens, that terrifies me that I should have lived and never did. Reality TV doesn't have this effect on me. Back then, though, all this was confusing. It was feared by others that I might relapse into literature, by which I mean allegory, symbol, the tropes of time dancing, of books that didn't have a particular beginning or end, or at least not in that order. By whom I mean the publisher, a man by the unexpected name of Gene Paley. He had been quite specific in this regard. I was to tell a simple story simply, and when it was not simple, when it dealt with the complexities of the spectacular crime, simplify, illustrate by way of anecdote, and never have a sentence that lingered longer than two lines. It was whispered around the publishing house that Gene Paley was frightened of literature, and not without good reason. For one thing, it doesn't sell, and for another, It can fairly be said that it asks questions that it can't answer. It astonishes people with themselves, which, on balance, is rarely a good thing. It reminds them that the business of life is failure, and that the failure to know this is true ignorance. Maybe there is transcendence in all this, or wisdom in some of it, but Gene Paley didn't see himself in the transcendence game. Gene Paley was all for books telling you one or two things over and over again, but preferably only one. Selling, Gene Paley would say, is telling. Thank you.
So now, comedy or what? That's Kif, introduction to the voice of Kif, the central character. Now, I deliberately didn't say anything about the setup, though you probably, a lot of you will know it already, and I deliberately didn't because I wanted it to speak as fiction before we went into the background of it, because the background of it actually comes from not fiction, from a different publishing adventure of yours.
It does, but I'm very glad that you, Claire, concur with the Daily Mail, who have already got their review out and read the whole novel, as it should be, as fiction, but did criticise me for what they said was the implausible setup of the novel, which happens to be the only true thing in it. And that true thing is that many years ago, nearly 30 years ago, I was working as a builder's labourer trying to write my first novel when late one night I received a phone call from Australia's most famous con man and corporate criminal, a rogue by the name of John Friedrich. Now, John Friedrich had been headline news. He'd taken over a small charity and turned it into this Thunderbirds-type organisation with about 500 men under arms in a sort of paramilitary organisation. He had a navy, he had an air wing, he had submarines. He even had Idi Amin's helicopter. And they did extraordinary, if occasionally inexplicable, things like being the first people in Australia to leap out of airplanes with our stations attached to themselves. And this rightly led people to be suspicious. And then people on the left began to fear that it was actually a CIA front, and this became a very widely held idea. Then the whole thing went belly up, and there was the largest manhunt in Australian history, and Friedrich was pursued across the great continent of Australia and eventually arrested where the land ran out and the ocean began, at Monkey Mere in West Australia, extradited back to Melbourne, and he'd been in the watch house for all of about an hour when Australia's leading celebrity agent, a man by the name of Harry M. Miller, called him and said, "Don't sign anything, I'll cut the deal." And he got the deal that people in that sort of situation of criminality and celebrity get themselves into in Australia, and was immediately offered a very lucrative publishing contract. A year and a half went by, Friedrich was released on bail and produced absolutely nothing, being criminally indisposed to putting anything on paper. And the publishers gave him ghostwriters and editors to work with, all of whom ran out in horror very quickly because he was an abhorrent individual to work with. And so they said, if you won't work with our people, you find a writer. Well, Friedrich didn't know any writers, but his bodyguard, a Tasmanian, said, "I've got a mate back in Tasmania who wants to be a writer." And in this way, literature happens. And so my phone rang, and it's Australia's most wanted at the other end. And he said, will you ghostwrite my memoir in 6 weeks if I pay you $10,000? And I reflected on this. and I thought, what will this do to my literary reputation? And on further reflection, I realised, not having written even one novel, I had no literary reputation to damage. And so the next day I flew to Melbourne and began work with this strange man who turned up at the publisher's office in disguise with a fake beard, looking a bit like sort of Yasser Arafat dressed up as Austin Powers. And he was a man of infinite secrets, and the first secret he made me swear to was that we were to tell nobody in the publishing house what we were actually working on. And I said, well, what do I say? And he looked around and he drew breath and he said, well, tell them we're co-editing an anthology of German medieval folk verse. And so there began a strange dance that went on for about 3 weeks, in which I asked questions and he never answered them. And then he shot himself dead.
3 weeks after you'd started. Into the 6 weeks of the book contract.
And then the publisher did what publishers do when they're doing their job, and they were everywhere in the media saying they had a tell-all memoir that answered all the questions that were now being asked about a man who, it turned out, although he'd been given the Order of Australia, didn't actually have a birth certificate or even a passport, the questions about where the hundreds of millions of dollars had gone. But the publisher said they wouldn't divulge any details. As well they wouldn't, because I was now sitting in a pub in Hobart desperately trying to make them up. And another 3 weeks passed, and it's said of most writers' first novel that they're autobiographies, but in my case, my first autobiography was rapidly developing novelistic tendencies. I finished the book. It came out, was an immediate failure. There was a campaign by an organisation called Don't Buy Books from Crooks, which I would have found offensive in other circumstances. But I'd received the $10,000 by this stage, which was good, as Woody Allen once said, if only for financial reasons. And with that, I was able to stop being a builder's labourer and work for 6 months on finishing what became my first novel, Death of a River Guide. So that is, I don't normally concur with the Daily Mail, but that was the implausible setup for this novel. And years and then decades passed, and a strange sort of new world came into being, in which lies became alternative facts, reality was denied by other lies, and the more implausible the lie, the more people seemed willing to believe it. And when one day I read that Mark Zuckerberg had said that privacy was no longer an acceptable social norm, he reminded me deeply of Friedrich, whose real interest wasn't in stealing hundreds of millions of dollars, but it was in controlling people and having absolute power over them. And the way he did this was by finding out every detail of their private life and then exerting control of them through that knowledge. And I began to think more about my time with Friedrich and how he'd frightened me, because he was the first person I ever met that I thought was evil. I also thought of how we no longer talk about things like evil and truth, and I wanted to, I thought these were things that we needed to, that I wanted to write a book that asked questions about these sort of subjects. And so I began the labour of writing the book. The question of privacy particularly haunted me. Gabriel Garcia Marquez said that everybody has a public life, a private life, and a secret life. But I think that's true. But now in the world that was forming, people had been persuaded to become their own big brother, and private life was becoming increasingly debased. And Zuckerberg also talked about how in the future we would no longer have one identity at work and another with our friends and family. We would only have what he called the integrity of one identity, our online identity. And this seemed to me to be a terrifying prospect, because it leads us to a point. When you only have one identity, it denies something fundamental in our humanity, which is we know implicitly we're not one thing, we're not one identity, but a multitude of possibilities.
In the piece that you wrote for The Guardian yesterday, I think it was, you made the point that this is coming from a man who tapes up his microphone, doesn't himself partake of this public identity that he says is going to be our communal identity.
Yeah, Zuckerberg does, James Comey does, Julian Assange does, all the people who seem to know about how these technologies work seem to be very concerned about their own privacy. But for the rest of us, it is as if we're no longer to be allowed that. And it seems to me this is the darkest dream of totalitarianism now made our daily lives, and we carry it in our back pocket.
And that is linked with the tradition, the popularity of memoir in your mind, is it, or of autobiography?
Well, I felt these new, I mean, again, in the solipsism and narcissism that characterises our age, I was reminded of Friedrich's solipsism and narcissism, the way he was always the first person in his world, and he demanded everybody else see him as the first person. And now we were all being encouraged to be the first person on social media to see whatever answers there were to be had in this life. We were to somehow find them within ourselves. And that was took all forms of madness, from middle-aged men road cycling to mindfulness and so on. And in literature, it expressed itself in the rise of the cult of the literary memoir. I mean, but memoirs existed as a form since St. Augustine. But what happened over the last 10 years is that literary memoir became seen as a preeminent form, particularly in North America. It became a dogma, and the dogma arose from the idea that reality had outstripped fiction, and fiction could no longer do justice to the world we now found ourselves in. And in that world, the only literature that had purpose and had validity was one rooted in experience, and that was a memoir. But really, I think my own experience in writing a memoir was anyone who reads a memoir as a truth is terribly deceived. And so I wanted to use to mock the form of the memoir and write a novel that purports to be a memoir, but in fact is a novel, because it seemed to me that more than ever, we needed the truth that fiction offers us, that the novel is an entertainment, but it's an entertainment that arises out of a great aesthetic and philosophical and spiritual tradition that is the history of the novel. And we can have stories as lies, but they poison our society, or we can have the stories as fiction, which seem to me, when they do their job properly, it doesn't have answers, but it asks the necessary questions we need to ask of ourselves and our time.
I want to dig down a little bit into the relationship of this with your biographical detail, autobiographical detail, because Kiff's wife is having twins, your wife was having twins. He's introduced to Ziggy by his best friend, who is bodyguard to Ziggy, as was the case with Siegfried. You went canoeing together. You have some rapids named after you, don't you, in Tasmania?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
In view of your heroic exploits in a canoe, presumably.
No, foolish exploits. where I would fall in or something terrible had happened. There's no.
They're called Flanagan's Surprise.
Yeah. Flanagan's Folly.
Flanagan's Folly. And there is a lot of reality stitched into this.
Yeah, but the history of literature is a history of robbers and thieves it's a Milky Way of theft, and writers steal from their own lives, the lives of others. They steal from a sob they heard down a corridor decades before, or laughter behind another door that they hear that day. They steal from other pieces of art. They take from everywhere. But in the mashup, there arises a new light. And that new light in literature is story. And I think what defines us as a species different from any other is the way we seek to divine the world through story. And story originally was superstition, and then it was family, and then it was the tribe, it was religion, nation, science, politics, and so on. But the supreme form of story, I think, is the novel, you know, and it is that I wanted to use to tell this story. And I just took elements from my own life and then invented different characters and destinies. And I mean, if this were a memoir, if this were a truthful book, I would be in jail, you know, for what the writer character does, isn't it?
And one of the big differences between you and Kiff is that you became a writer and he didn't. he doesn't become
well,
a writer.
I hope there are other differences. No, he's a rather repellent character.
Who are we to know what the differences are?
Well, maybe I am, you know. No, I mean, the character in it, the writer character begins feeling, because he has this arrogance of thinking that the artist has a moral and intellectual superiority, he looks down on the con man. But as he teeters on the abyss each day in his exchanges with him, he slowly discovers that the con man has a coherent view of life, and it is the view that this world is evil. And he finds that immensely attractive, and he's undone because of his arrogance. So I never felt attracted to John Friedrich's vision of the world, but this character is drawn to it and slowly finds the abyss he's staring into has consumed him until he is the abyss himself.
Ziggy has a knack of coming up with things that sound profound, statements about life and being and good and evil and existence, truth and lies. But actually you realise the more he comes up with them that they're just trite.
Perhaps, but they're also attractive.
And they're very attractive.
And he's also got a cogent outlook on the world, which he doesn't seek to sell to anybody else. But he believes the evidence of the world is that the world is evil. And I've met people who genuinely believe that. And I was brought up in an era where evil was explained by environment. And evil wasn't something implicit in us. It was something external to us that could be solved by good governance, proper parenting. There was always an action that could negate the effect of evil. But when you meet people who believe in evil, you suddenly realise this may not be so, that perhaps evil exists, that perhaps evil is attractive. Perhaps evil is a force that exists within us all. And I think over the last 30 years, we lost sight of the power of evil in our world. And I think in part that the collapse of communism brought this moment of complete triumphalism, and part of the triumphalism in the West was the sense that that the West had triumphed because of its economy, and people really only existed as economic units, and there was no longer a spiritual component to our understanding of what human beings were. But I think that's led us into many follies, and not the least of it is this failure to understand the role evil has in our world.
Richard Flanagan there. First Person is published by Chatto & Windus in the UK and Penguin Random House in Australia. It'll be out in the US in April 2018. Jesmyn Ward's Sing Unburied Sing is published by Bloomsbury in the UK and Australia and Scribner in the US. Both are available in hardback now. Next week, we keep looking at keeping things alive. De-extinction, if you will, be it the reality of bringing back the woolly mammoth or the reappraisal of a forgotten genius's reputation. All that with Michael Brooks and Britt Ray. There are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. You can find us there as well, of course, or just start up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join the conversation too, either by commenting on The Guardian's website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezinian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.